Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Diehl, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with novelist Vikram Chandra, the author of a much talked about, recently published book, Sacred Games. It is a crime thriller, although saying that I think doesn't fully describe to you the kind of book that it is. It is an epic. It is set in Bombay. It follows one of the city's police investigators as he looks into the death of a major crime lord. It also tells the life story of this dead mob boss that is narrated in first person from beyond the grave. And there are many other characters as well. In other novels, perhaps they would have been minor characters. In this one, Vikram Chandra gives us really much more fully realized second characters that we would expect to find in many other novels. They all live in a very complicated web of social relationships and where sometimes it's a little difficult to figure out where that line between good and evil and right and wrong is. He is joining us this morning by telephone to talk about the book. We're very pleased to have him on the show. The number here, if you'd like to give us a call, if you'd like to participate in the conversation, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He was born in New Delhi. He was educated in India and in the United States. He attended Pomona College, where he graduated with a bachelor's degree in English with concentration in creative writing. After that, he went east. He attended film school at Columbia University in New York. His first novel was Red Earth and Pouring Rain. It was written over several years at writing programs at Johns Hopkins and at University of Houston. He's also published a collection of short stories titled Love and Longing in Bombay. That was published in 1997. He is now teaching creative writing at the University of California at Berkeley and divides his time between Mumbai, and Berkeley, California. And the book, by the way, was published in January by HarperCollins, so it is out there in the bookstores if you'd like to read it. Questions are certainly welcome. I'd like to call in and talk with our guest, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Vikram Chandra, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. I enjoyed reading the book very much.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much. Your interest, I gather, in doing this story, at least in part, was prompted by what was going on in Bombay in the 80s and the 90s when there was a lot of gang violence. There was a lot of there were people who were threatened by organized crime. What was life at that time in Bombay like?
Well, the organized crime really expanded in its size and power during the 80s and 90s. Before that, when I was growing up, crime existed, of course, but it was something of a cottage industry, you know, small neighborhood groups at the largest. And then in the 80s, a couple of very charismatic and ruthless and intelligent men converted that cottage industry into a much more corporate kind of structure. And they did this very explicitly. That's why the gangs in Bombay are actually called companies. So, you know, they have hierarchical structures and you know, division of responsibilities and so forth. And so as the economy grew, these people, of course, wanted a cut of that growing cake. And then the level of violence escalated so that in the early 90s, for the first time, an AK-47 was used in broad daylight on the streets of Bombay for a gangbang hit. So there was a point in the 90s where you would open the paper every morning and there would be like a cricket score or something, the number of people killed, you know, during the last day and night. Also, extortion was one of their major avenues for bringing in cash, and the film industry has always been one of the primary targets. And my family back in India is associated with the film industry. So I actually knew people who were getting extortion calls, and if you refused to pay up, they would actually come after you and try and kill you. So I knew people who were getting shot at and wounded. And then my brother-in-law, who's a film producer and director, got one of these calls, and he refused to pay up. And suddenly then His house had to be surrounded by armed bodyguards, and my little niece and nephew were growing up in this world where guns were part of the everyday landscape. So all of this was quite provocative, and it came very close to home, and I started thinking about why this was happening and what the nature of it actually was, and then started thinking seriously about writing a book about it.
One of your main characters, the police inspector, he first appeared in one of the stories in Love and Longing in Bombay. So he was a character that you had started to think about what life would be like for a policeman. He is a Sikh, and at least in the story, it makes it sound as if there aren't very many Sikhs who are in the police department, and they're certainly a minority in India. Why did you want to make him a Sikh?
Well, as it sometimes happens, you know, the characters appear to you almost fully formed. And so when I first started seeing this guy, thinking about him, he was already a Sikh. And I could make all sorts of after-game guesses about why that was. So I had some friends when I was growing up, very close friends who were Sikhs and so forth. But it was only after I started writing about him and thinking about the fact that there are Sikhs in the Bombay police force, but very, very few. It became apparent that it would be useful to have him be a kind of outsider in the department. It gives him a certain distance from the local politics and the struggles that are very rooted in the location. And I liked that distance, so found myself very happy that he had been a Sikh right from the start.
Mm-hmm. His father was also a police officer, and as far as we know, a good and honorable man. Certainly, Sartaj, your character, believes that, although he also understands that there are things about his father's life that he doesn't know.
Right.
And it seems that he is in some ways torn between feelings about his father and wanting to be the kind of man his father was. And there's also another man who functions in a way as kind of a father figure. At least he is a mentor. He's a senior police commander and a man who has, it seems, taken every opportunity to enrich himself, every opportunity that has come along in the course of doing his job. And it seems that Sartaj is torn between which of these two men he's going to model himself after.
Right. That's very accurate. I think there is generationally in India a sense of falling off from the ideals of the generation that brought about independence. All of us, I think, have somewhere in our family trees a grandfather or an uncle who was an idealistic freedom fighter or something. And it's a trope that you often see in popular literature and film especially. The increasing amount of corruption that then slowly takes over the country, and when people like Parulkar, who's the man that you're speaking of, who's Sartaj's mentor, becomes a complete part of that system and thrives in it, the only way Sartaj has of maintaining some degree of integrity is by, as he puts it, staying small. So he understands that if he just does his job as a beat cop and doesn't get too ambitious and works on small cases, he won't have to compromise himself in very large ways. But if he wants to go up the ladder, many more dangers await. And so in some sense, his father also, who retired as a not very senior policeman, is also a model of that sort, somebody who refuses the temptations of largeness, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But the question then becomes for Sartaj, which of these two is a better thing to be? Is staying small merely a matter of being timid, and is becoming big sometimes a good thing? Parulkar, the senior Sartaj's mentor, once tells him, we are good men who have to be bad to keep the worst men from taking over. So his argument is that if you want to actually be an effective policeman, you have to make your compromises.
It seems that Sartaj believes that to a point.
Right.
But he's not willing to take it as far as Parolkar does.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what fascinated me about the world that these policemen live in. Like you were saying, I started thinking about this in Love and Longing in Bombay, and there it was just a story about a domestic murder. And I started to meet policemen and people in that world, and then after that book was finished, stayed friends with a couple of them. And they were always telling me behind-the-scenes kinds of stories, and it seemed to me that policing anywhere in the world, but especially in Bombay, is a hugely ambiguous activity. I mean, you have to make, you know, dozens of moral decisions every day. If you're trying to catch bad guy A, usually the best information comes from bad guy B. But then you have a relationship with bad guy B. So now how far do you let him continue with his activities? And then if he, you know, on Diwali, the Hindu New Year, if he sends a basket of fruit to your house, do you keep it? Or, you know, your children might want the fruit, but do you send it back? So it's a very slippery kind of slope that you're always walking across. Mm. I wouldn't do it for any money in the world, but I think the people who do it, it's extraordinarily easy to get to become prey to certain kinds of corruptions, but it's also a very necessary job.
Just to very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour at Focus 580, Vikram Chandra. He's the author of a recently published novel, Sacred Games. It was published by HarperCollins in January. It has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of positive reviews, and we're pleased to have him talking with us. He teaches creative writing at University of California and now divides his time between the United States and continues to have connections and family in Mumbai. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just, again, so people can understand the form that the novel takes, there are these two main stories that run through the book. Early on, we're introduced to Sartaj and see him going about doing his work. And then he gets an anonymous tip. Someone calls him and says that if he was interested in apprehending this notorious crime lord who had been living outside of India, the anonymous tipster says, "I'll tell you where you can find him." And Sartaj indeed goes there, finds him in a kind of a fortified bunker, manages to break in, but then finds that the crime lord has committed suicide. So then from that point, we have this interesting thing going on that on one hand, the crime lord himself from beyond the grave gives us his life story. And that alternates with the account of Sartaj as he's been tasked with trying to figure out what happened, you know, why what the crime lord was doing there, what was going on in his life. So we have these two stories that exist side by side that in a sense overlap. And yet the reader is privy to information that certainly Sartaj never gets. So we get the whole story. And that's one of the reasons it's such a big book. That's one of the, I think every review made note of the fact that it's a big book, and it is. So we have these two characters, and we get to see the two of them in their life. In addition to the policeman that we've talked about, there is this man, Ganesh, who is a Hindu crime boss, someone who started out very poor and managed to claw his way up to get to be this major crime boss. In addition, as you said, in trying to get ready to do the book, you spent some time talking with police officers. You also spent some time talking with crooks and criminals.
Right. So when I started seriously thinking about writing the book and started doing it, I asked my friends in the police force and then also a couple of very good crime journalists that I've become friends with if they could put me in touch with anybody who knew about this world. So I talked to all kinds of people, lots of policemen and journalists, sociologists, people who do social work in the slums, and then also some people from other side of the legal line. It was strange. I think that the high level guys, the big bosses, were in some were usually easier to get hold of and to talk to than one would think. And I finally figured out that the reason for this is that they're very public figures. If you think of Al Capone and his heyday in Chicago, that's what some of these people are like. They're nationally famous. So they tend to act like corporate heads. You know, they understand the use of the media and spin. And so if they think you are in any way connected to the media, it isn't that hard to get on the phone, at least with some people, and talk to them. And I actually ended up meeting a few of them face-to-face, which was an interesting experience. The low-level guys, the soldiers on the front line, the young ones, those people were much harder to get hold of because they're always frightened. They're afraid if a gang war is going on, they're afraid of being spotted and bumped off by the rival gangs or the police is after them. They tend to sleep only one or two nights in any given place. So with them, it was more complicated. You had to set up a meeting point and go and stand on a street corner, and then some kid would come and get you and lead you through some lanes, and then finally you end up meeting the person that you were looking for. And the reason I guess I was interested in doing this was that I think, like everyone else who thinks of himself as a good bourgeois citizen of the world, crime to me existed far away, in a sense. I'd seen it in the movies. It had impacted my life in the form of burglaries and muggings a couple of times in my life, but that was about it. Actually talking to people and trying to understand where they came from was an essential part of the writing process for me.
I read in one of the many things that I read, there was a nice quote from your wife. The story was that she was reading part of the manuscript at some point when you were working on it, and she said of this man, Ganesh, the crime lord, she said to you something like, "I hate it how you made me like him so much." And that does raise in my mind the question, why, for people like that, bad people, you know, the Ganesh, Gaetanda, and Tony Sopranos of the world, you know, people like that. Why is it that we find them fascinating?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons that I can think of instantly. One is that their lives seem to inherently have a kind of drama that might be lacking from ours. You know, if you go to work 9 to 5, you come back, you raise your kids. I mean, you have your tragedies and your unhappinesses, but it's not quite as exciting as, you know, running around trying to carve an empire out of a slum. And then also, I think we live vicariously. There's a little bit of gangster in all of us. And, you know, if you live in India and you're waiting in some line at a bank and the people behind the counter are treating you like, you know, very, very badly. There's a point at which you get so angry that you wish you could jump over the counter and, like, you know, slap somebody upside the head. But you don't do it because, you know, you understand that's not good, but that's not a good thing to do. And I think the gangster, as a fictional figure, always has worked as a living embodiment of things that we might want to do, but is also at the same time a frightening figure. And so what happened to me was when I started working on the book, my own family was being threatened. So I was very, very angry and fearful and, of course, thought of these people as some kind of monsters, some people who existed on some other plane. And I think we tend to do that with people that we consider evil. And what happened to me was as I got further into the book and met more and more of them and talked to them sometimes across a period of months, it started to occur to me that they were people just like me. They weren't that different. They were people who were wanted to be loved. They wanted to understand their place in the world and in the universe. They tried to find a moral universe to live in. Many of them were extremely religious, if that makes any sense. And of course it does. And finally, what I realized was that the terrible thing, the truly terrifying thing, is not that they are unlike me, but that they are very like me. That it is out of ordinariness that evil really springs. And I'm always, when I talk about this, I'm reminded about Hannah Arendt's famous line from the trials at Nuremberg when she's watching the Nazis be tried, and instead of the unreal monsters that she expects to see, she sees little bureaucrats, you know, little men in gray suits. And so then she thinks about the banality of evil. And I think that's what is frightening and profoundly interesting about the human race, is that we as ordinary people are sometimes often capable of the most monstrous evils.
Yeah.
So the effort then in the book became, I think for me, was to take this man, Ganesh Gaitonde, and understand him within his own context. He's obviously in many ways a complete psychopath and a killer, but I wanted to try and figure out, what does he think about himself? How does he think about his place in the world? And so when my wife said that, that was one a very happy moment for me as a writer, because I knew I'd gotten under her skin.
Yeah. I wonder if part of the appeal of that character or someone like him is that, in a kind of a warped way, he is the classic self-made man.
Oh yeah,
and he has, and it strikes me that this is a society where there is a lot of striving, where everybody is trying to the extent that they can to move up, if only a little bit. And here is someone who comes from nothing, becomes wealthy and powerful, even though he kills people and commits crimes to do it. He truly is a man who has pulled himself up by his own bootstraps.
Right. And I think especially this is true of India in the 80s and 90s, as we sort of crack open this very sleepy socialist economy, as capital actually starts to flow. There's a sense of change in the air, which is still going on. I mean, the economy is expanding at this enormous rate. But the sense that people like Ganesh then have is that there is this enormous wealth that you can have if you can climb far enough and fast enough. And so I think often, for instance, the soldiers, the frontline operatives, aren't from the very poorest parts of the population. I've met many of them who have at least a high school education. In some cases, they've gone to college, and they're lower middle class boys, but what they understand, what happens to them is that they see this world of possibility dangling before their eyes, and enormous consumption, you know, big cars, people eating at very expensive restaurants. They know what they don't have, and they understand that if they work in, you know, some sort of government office for the next 40 years, they might never get it. And then somebody smart comes along and says, you know, here's a pistol and 20,000 rupees a month. And if you work well, you could become Ganesh Gaitonde. It's a very, very, if you have the courage to take that path, or the stupidity, I suppose, it's a very tempting thing to dangle in front of somebody's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways Ganesh Gaitonde embodies the change in India that happens in the 80s and 90s and is continuing now.
You know, it's something else that certainly struck me reading the story, and I would be interested in having you talk about, is the way in which it seems to me that people in the society, and it, to a greater extent, I think, that, you know, than in our society or in my life, people do inhabit this very complex web of social relationships, and that people are making deals all the time, and that, in fact, your ability to get your needs taken care of might really depend on your connections and who you owe favors to. And then who that person owes a favor to, and that it's right. There's this this very complicated accounting going on of keeping track of favors taken, favors given, and connections. In this way, connections between people are very important.
Right. Yeah. No, that's certainly true of India, and I guess it is everywhere in the world, but especially in a culture where you know, there's lots of bureaucracy and things are hard to get done, there's corruption. What you start to realize very early in your life is that in order to survive, you depend on a system of favors given and favors remembered. You know, it also has to do, I suppose, with my sense of the way that corruption works. Again, for me, as an angry Indian citizen, it's very easy to look out at the world and say, you know, everything's corrupt and everything's bad, and then stop at that. And very early when I was starting to work on the book, I realized that that was, in some sense, a huge cliche. And what I got really interested in was, well, okay, so corruption exists. How does it actually work? Who pays whom, how much? Where does the money go to? How does the money flow? And then how does the whole system keep on going on the basis of this movement of money and power and influence? I suppose also very early in writing the book, something happened that opened up the book in a certain way. When I began writing the book, I was thinking of it just as a conventional, you know, 250 to 300 page story about local crime down the street from me. So I was going to open with a dead body, and then, you know, 300 pages later, everything would be wrapped up. And what happened was, as I started talking to people, I remember this one moment that became very important where a senior policeman in Bombay was talking to me about a particular shootout that had taken place in the early 90s. And he said, look, I can tell you about that encounter, about that incident, but if you really want to understand what's going on, you have to go to New Delhi and talk to these two people. And what he was trying to tell me was that what seems local has connections with things that happen very far away. So, in other words, if you're going to talk about local crime, you're obviously talking about politics. The two are intertwined. And if you're going to talk about politics in India today, and I think anywhere in the world, you're also in some ways talking about religion. And then the media, all of these things are connected. And in the subcontinent, of course, all of this exists within the context of what is called the Great Game, which is the struggle for power and dominance between nation states in the area. So what happened was that as the scope of the book grew to try and include all of these things, the texture of the book became, I think, a way to explore how all of us are connected and how we are forced to make choices in our lives, but often don't understand why. You know, when a bomb goes off in a train in Bombay, in a terrorist attack, we might not have any comprehension of who did it and why, but the reasons for it might exist halfway around the world. So I think that sense of network, of how we all live in this mesh of connections, political and historical, became for me a very important thing to try and catch in the book.
Mm-hmm. As you say, there's a lot in this book. You deal with a lot of things. The two stories that we've talked about, the life story of the gangster and the story of the policeman as he investigates the gangster, both of those could have been books by themselves. And then you invest a lot of time trying to get the reader to have some sense of life in Bombay and what it's life and like, and life in India and what it's like. And I think that also, in addition, you have given more dimensions to some of the secondary characters that would have truly been secondary characters maybe in somebody else's book. So that all goes to making it a big book. And I think that I mentioned that everything I read about it, every review, made a point of talking about the fact that it is a big book, and it is. It's over 900 pages long.
Right.
And I know I read some things where you said, well, that you didn't exactly start out with the idea that you were going to write a 900-page book. But once you had that book, did you think, now I'm going to shop this around to publishers, but what kind of a reaction am I going to get when someone looks at the manuscript and sees how long it is and say, and they say, look, we can't, this 928 pages, I'm sorry, we just can't do that. You've got to cut some stuff out of here.
Right. Well, you know, before we sent it out, my wife Melanie, who's also a writer, and I mean, we sat around for a couple of months taking a very, very careful look at the book and experimenting with excising parts of it. And what I found was that every time I took something out, I would lose some essential strand of not just plot, but emotion or history, and the book would become something completely different. So finally, I just sort of rolled my eyes and said, okay, well, this is the animal that it wants to be. And I sent it out, and I completely agree. I mean, with you, I was thinking that the reaction we're going to get from potential publishers is going to be, well, maybe skeptical at least. And so when all the excitement started over the book, over the manuscript and everything that followed, that was completely unexpected and kind of bizarre.
Hmm.
And then after we'd actually settled on a publishers and I was working with my editors, we had another go at it with, you know, working with the editors. And again, it became very, very difficult to take anything out. So as strange as it may sound, I think the 900-page length that it has now is the shortest the book could be. And I hope the reader, you know, once you get started, it doesn't feel like you're doing something, you're climbing up a very high mountain or something like that, that the book actually flows along and takes you along with its narrative. And I hope by the end the reader feels like this was the correct length.
Well, I would certainly say, having read the book, that I didn't feel like I had climbed a mountain. I suppose, though, sometimes with books like this, I would say that I'd felt like I'd taken a trip.
Yeah.
That I had gone somewhere. And perhaps that, you know, if someone asked me, well, what did I really like about the book, I think that I would say that when I read fiction, I'm looking for something that will take me someplace that I've never been. And I think that this book does it. And at the same time, I think you can, the characters and the themes aren't completely foreign. I think anyone can identify with them. And at the same time, I think that you would come away with a feeling that maybe you had gained a little bit of insight into another, into a culture, into a place that was different, that was really different from yours. That, at least that's what I would say.
Yeah, that's good to hear. It's interesting that you talk about it as a trip, because some of the writers that I personally enjoy reading the most are 19th century writers from the United Kingdom and from India. And these are people who are operating with a different kind of narrative pace. And I'm talking about people like Trollope and Thackeray and Dickens, for instance, where you start reading one of their books and it's like diving into this world.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back after reading, and you take a break after a few hours, you feel dizzy, and the real world seems a little unreal. And I love that feeling of being able to go into a fictional universe and stay there for a while. So I suppose one ends up trying to do something like the books that, you know, you yourself gain pleasure from and are devoted to.
I certainly did in reading reviews and reading articles about the book. There were many references to, at least the reviewers and people were writing about it, references to being Dickensian, you know, making that comparison to Dickens. And I'm sure that there are a lot of writers who would, you know, would that would make them pretty nervous. They'd say, no, please don't do that. Don't compare me to Charles Dickens. It sounds so is that that kind of comparison is something actually you're okay with that. If someone has that kind of response to the book, you would say, well, that's pretty much what I had in mind.
Well, those are pretty big shoes to fill, but yes, in a humble kind of way, I'm very happy about it. Yeah, I like I was saying, I love that kind of, what I like about those books is the narrative pace that keeps you turning the page, and then also their ability to create a universe, a sort of social environment full of different classes and kinds of people, so that both length and breadth are included in the kind of fictional universe that you enter. And so maybe my own writing has, I hope, some of that kind of feeling.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Vikram Chandra. His book, Sacred Games, was published in January by HarperCollins. You can certainly find it in the bookstore. He is also the author of the novel Red Earth and Pouring Rain and a collection of stories, Love and Longing in Bombay. That was published in 1997. He makes his home now, actually divides his time between Bombay, and Berkeley, California, where he teaches creative writing at the University of California. Questions, welcome, certainly, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As I said, I think that everything I read about the book, there were probably two things that came up in almost everything. One, the fact that the book was long. The other was the fact that HarperCollins had paid a lot of money for it. And I guess I wonder, as a writer, that sort of preoccupation that maybe reviewers and interviewers and people have with something like that, do you either just say to yourself, well, it's a business and that's okay, I can live with that? Or does that in part annoy you that so much would be made of the fact that that you got a really hefty advance and that HarperCollins paid a significant amount of money for the book?
Right. Well, I think it's inevitable, and you have to be prepared for that. I mean, I should say first that for any writer anywhere in the world, I think getting paid well is a rarity. And so when it happens, of course you're ecstatic about it and grateful, and to sort of complain about it would be churlish. It would be stupid. But And I think so. Then people talking about it is inevitable. I think what is a little disquieting sometimes is when you start to feel like in some discussions of the book that starts to interfere with an understanding of the book as story, right, as narrative. And so I think that makes you a little bit sad. But I should also say that what I've learned from writing now, this is my third book, and I've been doing it for, you know, quite a while, is that books and stories have a very long life in the world, and that the initial reception, the reviews that you get early on, whether people like it or not, and so forth, is a very, very, it's not a very good predictor of what will happen in the long life of the book. And if you look back at history, you can see this happening again and again. You know, something that everyone's ecstatic about in the first month that it comes out, you look at the same book 5 years later and you wonder what all the fuss was about. And the other way around. You know, I think, you know, for instance, not that I'm comparing myself with him, but Melville and Moby Dick. And the poor man was savaged by the critics. You know, pretty much retreated from writing after that. And you read that thing now and you wonder, how could anybody not see its virtues? Mm-hmm. So I think if you're a writer, of, I suppose any kind of artist, I think you have to take these early reactions, you have to try and maintain a distance from them, both the good and the bad, because otherwise it's too disturbing either way. And can really, I think, mess with your head if you allow it to get to become part of your internal dialogue and your relationship with your work. Not that it's always easy to do and that you can do it, but at least one should attempt to have that distance.
I think that most of what I've read about the book has been in press either from the United States, or I'm sure that I read some reviews that were published in some British papers that were generally all quite positive. What sort of reaction has there been to the book in India?
Oh, it was very gratifying. It was like you were saying, it was generally very positive. what I was really happy about was that there were a couple of reviewers who I think of as very dyed-in-the-wool Bombayites, people who are very possessive about the city, you know, as people can be if they're born and bred there. And they, in their notices, or personally said to me that they recognized the city that I was writing about, and that is a very good thing when that happens. And also just emails from readers and letters and so forth gives me the sense that the book is working on several levels. One is just a story, but also as a representation of the city and what's happening in the country at large today. Not to blow my own horn, it just won an award called the Crossword Fiction Prize, which is it's a prize for the best fiction of the year. And like I was saying, I don't think prizes are any real marker of quality of fiction, but certainly it does give you a little smile on your face for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. That happens. So I'm very happy with the reception. I'm thinking in particular about one email that was sent to me by a police officer from the north of India that I'd never met him, don't know about him, and he liked it because he said that he recognized parts of his own life in the book, and I think that makes you very, very happy. It's gratifying because I intruded into a lot of people's lives during the writing of the book. I asked a lot of questions, some very personal and potentially dangerous kinds of questions of a lot of people. So I did feel the sense of responsibility of doing right by the people that I was writing about. And so when somebody like that says, you know, good job, it gives you a feeling of satisfaction.
As I said, I think for me, one of the great things about the book was the feeling that I had in some sense become immersed into a world, a culture, a society that was to me completely new, at least very different from right. from my life. And I think, though, for a reader that's perhaps not familiar at least a little bit with India, that can be difficult. And one of the things that you do with the book is that there are words, I'm presuming some of them may be Hindi, some of them, I guess, would be Marathi.
Yeah.
And there is a glossary in the back of the book, so if you want to look some things up, you can do that and add some very colorful words to your vocabulary, which we cannot use on the radio. And then there are things that are simply never defined. And if you really, I suppose if one was motivated enough, you could do that. And I think it's also, I would want to make sure people know that you can actually, I think you could actually read the book quite successfully without ever going to the glossary.
Right.
But if you're interested in what some of the words are, you can do that. And I'm interested in how you thought about that, your use of non-English words, knowing that probably most of the people who would be reading the book would be English speakers, and for them, they would either have to say, well, I don't care what that means, or I would have to try and look it up. You could, I suppose if you'd wanted to, you could have made it easier.
Well, right. Well, when I write, my primary audience is in India. So the audience that I imagine when I'm working is actually a very small one. It's my mother and sisters and a couple of friends and my wife. Almost all of whom live in the city or in India. So that's who I'm writing for. And it's gratifying and interesting to me that people from other parts of the world want to read the narrative, but I'm not writing for them in an immediate sense. So what I was trying to do was to use the English that people actually speak in the streets of Bombay, or elsewhere in India. And that English is a changing English. I think now we've got two or three generations of people who've grown up in post-independence India. And to us, We're aware of the colonial history of the language, but it also very much feels like one of our own tongues, one of many choices that you have. So if I were telling this story in a bar in Bombay to a friend of mine, the English that I would speak would be very sprinkled with words from other languages. And we would assume knowledge on each other's parts of that slang, those other words. And that very much is a part of the texture of the city and of the country itself, this multilinguality, switching from one language to the next in the middle of a sentence. I suppose for American readers, the closest you might have come to this is if you've heard people speaking Spanglish, for instance, the manner in which people go back and forth. So that's what I was trying to do, was to use that kind of spoken English in a literary kind of way, and use the rhythm and the texture of that to give to the reader a sense of the place itself. I should say, though, that some of the slang in the book is very, very particular. It belongs to the underworld. It belongs to the underworld of Bombay. And so that an Indian reader, even from, say, Chennai or from New Delhi, who's reading the book might not understand the specific meanings of the words at first glance. But I think that becomes part of the pleasure of reading. When I was growing up, we read a lot of British children's fiction. I remember being completely baffled by words like crumpet and clotted cream. I had no idea why people would eat something called clotted cream. Or I mean, if you think about it even now, an Indian reader reading an American novel, when you come across the phrase, I went to the 7-Eleven, you have no idea what a 7-Eleven is. But you get some sense of it, you know, because a character goes in and comes out with a bottle of milk. So you start to figure out the universe that the characters are living in through the context. And I hope then that readers from other parts of the world will have some of the same kind of pleasure, I think I would call it, of entering a foreign universe and then slowly figuring out its nuances. And for those who really want it, as you pointed out, there's a small glossary in the back of the book. There's a much larger one on the website, on my website, which you can actually access.
We are almost out of time. We have maybe a minute or so left. I know it is a terrible, terrible cliche to say of a novel that the place that it's set functions as character, but I think that in this case it's very true. And people's feelings for this place, and the pace of life, and the fact that grittiness and poverty live cheek by jowl aside great wealth. And the love for the place, that seems to be important, to certainly to both of the main characters, to Ganesh and to Sarchaj.
Right. There's a very famous Urdu writer named Manto who once wrote about Bombay, the city made me who I am. And I think for many of us who live there, that's the sense that you have of the place. Your sense of self is very tied up with the location, with the possibilities and the cruelties that this place offers you. And you develop a kind of love and hate for it. You know, as one of the characters puts it towards the end of the book, once the air of this place touches you, you're not fit for anywhere else. And I think that's the feeling that a lot of people have towards it. You think you're crazy for loving it, but then there it is.
So what do you feel like talking about what you might be working on now or what you think you might be working on next?
I'm actually taking a break, and a very determined break. I've actually got it marked on my calendar. And so what I'm trying to do is allow myself time when I allow myself not to think about writing else at all and just consume lots of books and movies and watch lots of bad television. And it's a great pleasure to not have that pressure of, you know, I have to write tomorrow morning, but just to sit around and feel like a child again and just feel completely free to indulge oneself.
Well, I certainly appreciate you giving us a time and talking about the book. I know that you had been on a very long tour and had been talking about the book a lot.
Right.
So I really much appreciate you giving it another hour and talking about the book. And certainly, as I said at the beginning, I enjoyed reading the book very much.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate it. Vikram Chandra, he teaches creative writing at the University of California, Berkeley. He divides his time between Berkeley, California and Mumbai, India. And if you'd like to read the book, it is out in the bookstores now. It's Sacred Games, was published in January by HarperCollins.